nation's first female governors served in brief honorary capacities or because they were married to incumbents who couldn't run again. The election of Ella Grasso in Connecticut 40 years ago changed that pattern. Since then, many states have elected women as governors, but their overall number remains small and is still at zero in Illinois. I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we'll ask why there aren't more women serving as governors and whether the situation could change, with Kelly Dittmar of the Rutgers Center for American Women in Politics and political reporter Tom Kasich of the News Gazette. That's coming up on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Whomever is elected governor of Illinois this November, it is almost certain to be a man. The most likely female prospect for governor, State Attorney General Lisa Madigan, took herself out of the running last year. Any other women candidate would have to be an independent or third-party candidate. Illinois has never elected a woman as governor, and neither have the neighboring states of Indiana, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Missouri. There are only five women serving as governors in the U.S. today, and going by the percentages, women are better represented in Congress than in the nation's governor's mansions. Today on Focus, we're going to talk about women governors and why there aren't more of them. Figuring out the details for us on a nationwide basis is Professor Kelly Dittmar. She's with the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. Welcome to the show, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And looking at the issue in Illinois is political reporter Tom Kasich of the News Gazette. Welcome back to Focus, Tom.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be here.
By the way, we welcome your questions on Focus and your comments. You can call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu, and you can reach us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Kelly, I wanted to, I had said it in brief, but as far as I can, if my math on percentages is right, about 20% of the U.S. Senate is female, about 17% of the members of the U.S. House are women, but only about 10% of U.S. governors are female. Also, there was not a woman elected as a U.S. governor on her own merits as compared to, say, being the wife or widow of an incumbent until Ella Grasso in Connecticut in 1974, but women were elected to Congress on their own merits much earlier, just about as soon as they were allowed to vote. Why has it been so much slower for women's progress in the office of governor?
Sure. I mean, I think definitely you're right. You know, we've had 35 women who've served as governor in 26 states, but that's been a relatively recent phenomenon, and it's still too low of a number. Over half of those women elected have served since 2000. So definitely we're talking about a recent rise of women as governors and still far from the progress we've seen at some other levels of office. I think there's a number of reasons why this might be the case. We know that a lot of the reasons why we see few women in office at all levels are consistent across executive or legislative office. So facing women governors as well as women running for legislatures are stereotypes of political office, recruitment and support structures. But I think these are often amplified for women running for the state's top executive. So when we talk about gender stereotypes in running for office, we talk about expectations of office holders. So for male executives, those are particularly masculine. So seeing someone as the sole leader, as the decider, as a decisive leader versus a collaborative leader, which is often associated with women and seen as a value in legislative or collaborative bodies. On the recruitment and support side, we just haven't had enough women putting their names forward as potential gubernatorial candidates. You mentioned in Illinois looking at, you know, just a few this cycle as potentials, and once, you know, Lisa Madigan decided not to, there weren't many other women to look toward or women talking about running. So we need more women in the pipeline, and we haven't seen that At the gubernatorial level. And then finally, I'd say as part of that, part and parcel, is the support, encouragement, and infrastructure provided by the powers that be in any given state. So to run for governor, you need a lot of money, you need a lot of party support, and you need folks to encourage you to run. It's not an easy race to run anywhere. And that's another thing that we've seen, both for women running for the legislature, but especially at the gubernatorial level, that those items, those essential items to get women to both consider running and be able to run successfully, especially party support and infrastructure, just haven't been there for women.
Tom, I'm wondering if you've seen that, how you've seen that play out in Illinois. I mean, I look at a legislature which certainly has women in it, but on the other hand, I'm trying to remember who the last top leader of a legislative body from one caucus or another who was a woman.
Well, we've got one now. Christine Redonio is the Illinois Senate president, but she's got a tiny little caucus.
You mean the Senate Republican leader?
Senate Repubs, yeah.
Okay.
But she's only got 19 of the 59 senators in there. But she overcame a stiff challenge last year to her leadership, and the male-dominated Senate Republican caucus stuck by her. But you're right. There are other leaders, but they're not the top leaders in the Illinois legislature.
And is there any particular reason we can see why that has been the case?
No, but it's quite obviously what's going on among the Democrats. You've got two guys who've been in there for a long time, and they're just going to hold on until maybe they die. Mike Madigan's been in there decades, and John Cullerton for, I think 8 or 10 years, and he's...
That's Mike Madigan, the House Speaker, and John Cullerton, the Senate President.
And, they've got strong majorities on both sides, and they're gonna hold on as long as those majorities persist.
Well, Speaker Madigan's position is a relevant one here, especially because of a female politician that everybody really thought was going to be a big gubernatorial contender this year, and that is Michael Madigan's daughter, Lisa Madigan, the state attorney general. She's in her second term and now running for a third term because she has decided not to run for governor. And she was in a situation where she was expected to challenge the incumbent, Pat Quinn, who is considered not the most popular governor in Illinois history. And she was seen as being an effective attorney general. And it didn't. In some ways, having Madigan as your father helps. In some ways, it hurt. But in particular, this way, it hurt because it was apparently clear that they felt that two Madigans in high office in Illinois would be too many for a lot of people. And Michael Madigan wasn't leaving anytime soon, so Lisa Madigan wasn't going to run.
That was really an exceptional, extraordinary admission by Lisa Madigan. Whether honest or not, she said she wasn't going to run because having a governor and a speaker of the House from the same family just wasn't appropriate, and she wasn't going to run for governor until he was out. He's been in the legislature since 1971, he's 71 years old. She must think that eventually he's going to retire or die in office, and she'll get her chance, but she's only 47 years old, so there's a lot of time left. She has the polls showed her ahead of Quinn. She's got an enormous fundraising advantage. As of last September, she had $4.8 million in her campaign account, and Quinn only had $2.9 million. There was every reason to believe she would run, but she didn't. But again, she has plenty of time to run in future elections.
And I can't help but thinking, and this is where stereotyping comes in, and Kelly, you can tell me if I'm stereotyping here. If the state attorney general offspring of Michael Madigan had been a son instead of a daughter, would this have played out in quite the same way?
That's a good question. I think that as with most things in gender and politics, it probably would have played out a little bit differently. I don't know, you know, her reasoning may have been something that would have held true for a male candidate as well, in that strategically he would see it as, you know, a disadvantage in campaigning that folks may call him out. But remember, we have a lot of political dynasties in this country, and folks, you know, you look at the Kennedys and you have a lot of males in succession and holding different offices at the same time, and it hasn't been seen as much of a problem. So I don't know. I don't know if it would have been differently. I think you all are more familiar with what exactly was going on in the state. But what I will say that it demonstrated, at least from afar, is that when we talk about potential women candidates, often we tend to put, especially when looking at gubernatorial or even now at the presidential level, we tend to put all our eggs in one basket. So we identify the woman that might run, and we talk a lot about her, and that's great. We want to do that, but I think as we do on the male side, we need to start having longer short lists, other women that we can identify, so that if a situation like this occurs where the woman that we think is best situated potentially decides not to run or something else happens, there are other women waiting or other women ready to make that decision to run who will be supported by the party and by folks in the state.
And that does, and maybe that tends to happen in a lot of politics where you see the race if there's been support coalescing around a woman, the idea that there could be another woman, say, in the primary field is sometimes a little tough for people to get their arms around, the same way as there might be another African-American in the primary mm-hmm. field. There are people who are just used to thinking of one at a time.
Sure.
And not exactly. Not the way they think of, say, all the white male candidates out there.
Exactly. It's still seen as an anomaly, right? So you still see that one person as, okay, we've checked off the box, we've got our woman candidate to put forward. And I think that is unfortunately still the case. You know, I've been arguing even at the presidential level, while Hillary Clinton may be the most likely candidate amongst all Democrats, not just women, we still need to be thinking about other folks and talking about them.
I'm wondering, first I want to say this is Focus, and I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about women governors and whether there might be more of them in the future rather than now when there are not so many. Our guests, Professor Kelly Dittmar of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University, and Tom Kasich, political reporter for the News Gazette. And we welcome your calls and comments as well. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. Kelly, when we look at the women governors we have now and have had in the past, does one party dominate over the other?
No, actually, we have a pretty even breakdown. I mean, we have, of the 35 women who served, 20 Democrats and 15 Republicans. You see a little more of partisan differences when we look at the number of women who've been major party nominees. So there have been 104 women who've been major party nominees since 1970, 65 Democrats, 38 Republicans. So in other levels of office, in the congressional level and state legislative level, we see an even more distinct sort of bias in that Democratic women are more likely to be in office. At the gubernatorial level, still a Democratic advantage, but a little less pronounced.
Is there any particular reason for that? Are Democratic voters, are voters who are going to vote Democratic more open to women? Are there more opportunities for women in the party structures?
Yeah. Historically, it's been sort of a combination of factors. One, women in general in the population and as candidates, as it follows, are more likely to identify as Democrats, and so ideologically and politically. So that's one sort of general reason. But the party infrastructure and support structures that have been in place for women have tended to lean towards the progressive and Democratic side, meaning that women have been able to navigate the Democratic Party structure both nationally and in all states a little bit more easily, at least historically, though there is some efforts and I think some progress for Republican women to date. And also, when I talk about infrastructure, it's not just the parties themselves, though they are very significant and very important, especially in certain states. I think Illinois is one. Here in New Jersey, where we're based, the party politics matter for women significantly. But it's also infrastructure like organizations, trainings, places that will help women, support women, and encourage them to run. So on the Democratic side, we have large organizations like Emily's List or Emerge or other organizations that train and financially support women. In Illinois, I know you have a Democratic women's organization as well. Those sorts of support structures just are not as apparent for Republican women and not in every state.
When you see the women who have been elected governor and maybe also the most viable women candidates, what sort of level of political experience are you seeing? Is it comparable to male candidates or is it different?
Definitely comparable or more. Often in most levels of office, there is both a perception among women often that they need to be more qualified. And then in reality, you know, we see in terms of questioning women candidates both by voters and by media, a sort of higher bar often set for women. So they know that they often need to be more qualified or at least emphasize their qualifications more than their male counterparts. And they often do have more. It's both to be tapped as candidates and to be willing to run. What's interesting, I think, you know, in talking about this specifically as we were talking about Lisa Madigan, a lot of the women who have served as governor have previously held statewide elected executive offices. So about 21 of the 35 women have been in some sort of statewide elected position in their states before either being appointed or elected as governor. So they're coming from high-level offices in order to be governor and use that experience, I think, to get there.
And I guess in Illinois, at least, that's the experience for a lot of male governors.
Sure.
As well, but certainly not all of them. Rob Blagojevich was a congressman. He was not a state. He did not hold a statewide office. But when I think of Pat Quinn and George Ryan and Jim Edgar and Jim Thompson, Dan Walker was another person who did not have that statewide experience. Did Otto Kerner come from a previous statewide office?
No. Nor did Ogilvy, nor did Jim Thompson. But some of those guys were federal prosecutors.
Being a federal prosecutor seems to be a good way to get some attention, especially if you're a federal prosecutor in the Chicago area where you have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
Right.
I wanted to talk to you, Tom, a little bit about the two women who ran for governor in Illinois as major party nominees, and I think they're the only major party nominees to date, and that is the late Don Clark Netsch, who ran in the 1990s against Jim Edgar, and Judy Bartopinka, now our state comptroller, who ran against Rod Blagojevich just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them had were experienced politicians who held statewide offices. Were they both comptrollers?
Topinka had been state treasurer. She'd been head of the Republican Party, state legislator, and Don Clark Netsch had been a state senator and a state comptroller. Yeah,
that's right. And she had also been active in the Constitutional Convention
back
around 1970, and they both lost with less than 40% of the vote.
Yeah.
Why do you think that happened? First thing I'm wondering, do you think their being women had anything to do with how they fared in Illinois politics?
It probably had something to do with it. But I think that, you know, overwhelmingly, in both cases, they were just outgunned financially, especially Topinka. I was looking back at the figures. She raised $10 million versus Blagojevich's $26 million. That's hard to overcome. Plus, he had the power of incumbency. And he had pretty effective campaign commercials, as we talked off air a little while ago about. We still remember Blagojevich's message in that campaign, and it had a tinge of sexism, too, I think. It was, what's she thinking? And it was always about something she said or some position she took, and he would just attack her kind of vaguely for being a Republican. In Netsch's case, You know, again, Edgar was the incumbent, and he was very popular with among all over the state, especially downstate. And she had some issue problems. She was opposed to the death penalty, which, you know, just that was 30 or 20 years ago, and now we no longer have a death penalty in Illinois. But that was a big issue, that campaign. And plus, she had supported a tax shift, proposing that property taxes be decreased and that the income tax, the state income tax, be increased.
And that the burden of paying for public education go to the income tax. And that was an idea which might have gotten more traction in downstate Illinois, but that wasn't necessarily where the votes are.
Right.
And then there are questions of how do you mechanically make that work, how you push all the legal levers to change the taxes. I remember that being debated. The curious thing about that was after Jim Edgar was reelected, he embraced Don Clark Netsch's idea.
Right. He and University of Illinois President Stan Eikenberry pushed that. It still has gone nowhere.
Now, I can only wonder what Don Clark Netsch thought when she saw that happening. I don't know if you ever had a chance to speak to her about that.
No, I haven't. I hadn't, no.
But knowing her, she had an opinion.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I wanted to just piggyback on what you were talking about in terms of, you know, I think that when we talk about women candidates and possible challenges that they face in running, what we know at all levels, and I think this is true at the gubernatorial level, in many cases their gender is not determinative, you know, of whether they win or lose, but it's the experience they may have on the campaign trail. And so those comments, those sometimes veiled and sometimes not veiled strategies by their opponents that address sex, mm-hmm. Often even in the images that candidates use. And again, that's something that's done against men too. You know, you use tired images, but sometimes that tired sort of, I know with Judy Bartropiga, this is something that came out sort of, if you use a tired image of somebody who's an older woman, that evokes different responses sometimes among voters. And then secondly, you know, in the campaign, even if those women are up against an incumbent or up against a hard fight, who's behind them? Is the party standing behind them? Are they supporting them financially? Are they there to fight with them? And that's something that we often look for. Are there some gender differences in that? We know in the last election here in New Jersey, the woman who ran against Chris Christie got very, very little support. Democrats came out in support of Chris Christie. The infrastructure was not there for her. It wasn't solely due to gender, but we think it may have played a part.
Well, Kelly, when you look at the women who have been elected governors, how have they navigated this political terrain where they may be up against a lack of political infrastructure support, if that's the right term, but also may have to deal with, say, veiled sexism on the campaign trail?
You know, I think it matters often where they come from. So the women who've run and been successful in Ann Richards in Texas, for example, I think ran very differently and had a different sort of approach than Madeleine Cunin maybe, in Vermont, because of the nature of that state and the politics of that state. So you look at it, Ann Richards, and her really strategy was to really take that, any sort of sexism, any sort of gender bias head on, to demonstrate and talk openly about the fact that a woman could and should serve in the nation's top executive office. Some other women have been particularly successful in garnering women's support, but support among populations like moms and families and folks who might see them as more in tune with what's going on in the day-to-day life of families. So Madeleine Cunin came into office. She had a long political experience before she became governor, but she got into office like many women do because there was an issue in her community that dealt with her children and education, and it angered her enough that she got involved. She decided there were the people who she was going to advocate for those issues weren't listening, and somebody like her needed to be there. So that personal story has often benefited a lot of women who've run to share that sort of empathy. And I think you're right, there's women voters sometimes have come particularly in support of some of those women candidates.
I mean, that's something that women will vote for women because because they see strengths there that they understand that men do not?
In some cases, we know that the gender gap is more motivated by party than by gender, and in essence, women vote more often for Democrats than they do Republicans, not women over men. But there is some evidence of a gender affinity effect, at least in the enthusiasm behind that candidate during a campaign. So on election day, some women may get a small boost from women voters, but it's a lot in volunteering, energizing the campaign, funding the campaign. Women donors are more likely, or women candidates, excuse me, are more likely to have more women donors. So in those ways, that affinity, that shared identity can be beneficial.
I'm wondering if there were, in the case of Illinois, Tom, if there were other factors that we hadn't thought of in the race between Blagojevich and Judy Bartopinka. I'm thinking that at that time, the previous Republican governor, George Ryan, was in prison, and the indictments against Blagojevich were still a few years in the future.
Yeah.
Do you think Topinka, regardless of any gender issues, just suffered from being a Republican candidate for governor?
Right. There's that point, and the Democrats were pretty well united behind Blagojevich at that time. Both Cullerton and Madigan were co-chairmen of his reelection campaign. And Topinka was, the Republican Party was more split, as it almost always is in Illinois. And she wasn't conservative enough for some people. She's pretty moderate. And she's always been pretty moderate. And there were people who were angry at her for the way she ran the party during her chairmanship and for her, you know, personal views on issues.
So these are just some things that she was going to have, that any candidate with her positions were going to have trouble with anyway.
Right, whether it was a man or a woman, but yeah.
Well, let's come back to these issues in a moment. Time right now for a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our look at women in the office of governor in the U.S. I'm Jim Meadows, and this is Focus on WILL. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guests today are News Gazette political reporter Tom Kasich and Professor Kelly Dittmar of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. We're talking about something Illinois, Indiana, and several other states have never had, a woman as governor. If you have questions or comments on this subject, maybe you see someone in Illinois right now, a woman who is of gubernatorial timbre that is perhaps being overlooked. We'd like to hear from you about that. Give us a call. It's toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Kelly Dittmar, I was wondering, do you know much about the first woman to be elected governor on her own merits, not attached to by marriage to an incumbent or a recently deceased incumbent. Ella Grasso of Connecticut, I believe, was elected 40 years ago. And how did she break that barrier?
You know, I think Ella Grasso was a political leader in Connecticut well before she became governor, and in many ways was how she got there. She was in the Connecticut House of Representatives. She was a floor leader. She was elected statewide as Secretary of State. And so she had sort of cut her political teeth well before she was elected governor in 1974, which is the case for a lot of women and a lot of men, of course, in running for statewide office. But she was somebody who had really established herself as a political woman, one of the few at the time who had a strong political reputation in the state. It was well respected. And by the time the position did open up, she was able and well situated to be elected. I think that that's really important, that she had really put herself in that position and that the voters in the state had seen her in that position. And we're also talking about Connecticut, which has had a pretty good history of women in leadership, so I think that helped her as well.
Are there any, I'm thinking of women governors recently, And where they can go from there. Often the governorship is seen as a way to run for president. Mm-hmm. I haven't quite seen that, but of course, Governor Sarah Palin became the vice presidential candidate for the Republicans, and I believe there were two recent governors in the Obama cabinet.
That's right.
who made that jump. When you look at the female governors today, do you see anybody who has the possibility or perhaps even the desire to go on the national stage politically?
I think of the women who are currently serving. So we have four Republican women serving, one Democratic woman. The most floated name and probably the most likely in this small group might be Susana Martinez, who's the governor of New Mexico, a Republican governor in a western state, a Latina, which is increasingly important and seen as beneficial in national campaigns as the voter base increases. I know in recent debates and discussions about whether Chris Christie would run or not run, there was also the secondary discussion of would he put her, bring her on the ticket as a vice presidential candidate. So her name has been floated in these conversations. She's also, I believe, a former prosecutor. So talking about that level of experience and expertise coming to the table. That said, I don't know that she's not had an easy time in New Mexico as governor, so that may hurt those chances going forward. Of the other women, I don't think they've risen to the top of any national conversations. Nikki Haley is well known and has gotten some attention, but it also struggles due to popularity in the state and the degree of conservatism. She is a conservative in the very conservative South Carolina. That may be difficult to wage into a national campaign. And of the other woman, Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire, is just, you know, governor from a small state who thus far hasn't gotten a lot of a national attention, though it doesn't rule her out. Mary Fallon in Oklahoma, and Jen Brewer in Arizona. Jen Brewer is stepping down and doesn't look like she'll have a future in politics at this point.
Meanwhile, there are several gubernatorial races besides Illinois this year, and already several women candidates running in the primaries. Do any of them stand out to you who may end up being elected governor later this year?
Sure. We have about 30, 27, I believe, women looking to run for governor this time around. And of those, there are a number that we think have a decent chance. So in Pennsylvania, probably most specifically, Alison Schwartz, current congresswoman, is one of the three Democratic women running. So it's a very crowded field thus far on the Democratic side to run against the incumbent Governor Tom Corbett, who's pretty unpopular in the state right now. She is the one of the Democrats leading in the current polls, and she has a lot of support in infrastructure due to being a multiple-term congresswoman and having a lot of support throughout the state. She'll struggle. She's Philadelphia-based, so those of you, you know, aware of Pennsylvania, she'll struggle with the rest of the state, similar to Illinois and Chicago, but I think that she has a strong chance. Another woman who might have a good chance, who recently officially put her name forward, is Rhode Island Treasurer Gina Raimondo. And so currently she's leading her Democratic primary opponent for an open seat race. So she could wage a pretty competitive race and might come out on top.
I'm wondering, Tom, now we don't have any women running for governor in the major parties, but we do have primary candidates for lieutenant governor, and it sounds like there's at least a good chance that the Republican nominee for lieutenant governor could be a woman this year.
Right. There's four Republican candidates for governor, and three of them have chosen running mates who are women. And of the two Democratic candidates, at least for now, Teal Hardeman is on the ballot, could be thrown off. His lieutenant governor candidate is also a woman. So you've got four out of six there, but the rest of the ballot is kind of devoid of women. I counted them up. Of the 24 statewide candidates, including for the U.S. Senate, only seven are women this year.
Okay. There have been more in other years?
I don't know. Probably not. But, you know, just think of the electorate.
Okay. And that's important because really the statewide offices, I think, as you were pointing out, Kelly, are sort of stepping stones for people who might want to be a governor or a senator would probably be the big things besides running for president. That worked for one senator the last few years in Illinois. But lieutenant governor, I'm not quite sure if the governor leaves office for any reason. Of course, lieutenant governor is in exactly the right place to be governor and then run for governor. But otherwise, we've had two female lieutenant governors in Illinois, and one of them in office right now, and she's decided to run for comptroller this year.
Yeah, I saw that.
that's Lieutenant Governor Sheila Simon, the daughter of the late senator and one-time lieutenant governor Paul Simon. Before that was Corinne Wood, who was George Ryan's lieutenant governor, and she made a bid for governor herself, I believe, after that, but really did not do well.
Right.
You know, and it's varied by state. So we have had four women who have done that shift from lieutenant governor to governor directly. Some of whom obviously were took charge after the governor resigned, or for any other reason the governor had to step down from office. So that, you know, we saw in 2000 a high in the number of women governors. A couple of those, I think two of them, were women who had shifted from lieutenant governor to governor. It's happened twice in Massachusetts. And so it's good to be there. That said, those women haven't necessarily always had an easy time then running for a full term. And so even, you know, you mentioned Corinne Wood, challenging just from lieutenant governor to run for governor, but even women like Jane Swift in Massachusetts really struggled to then try to pull from that appointment into a full term. But other women have been successful. So, you know, in six other cases, pretty prominent women governors. Again, I mentioned Madeline Cunin earlier, Mary Fallon, who's the current governor of Oklahoma. Beth Perdue was lieutenant governor in North Carolina. So there have been women who then have continued on to have pretty successful gubernatorial careers.
I'm thinking of one female governor we haven't talked that much about, but that's Sarah Palin. You know, one thing I'm wondering is she has been on the national stage ever since her run for the vice presidency, but how did she make the jump from being, I hesitate to call her a small town mayor in Alaska because I don't think there are that many big towns in Alaska, but she made the jump from a relatively small town mayor to being elected governor. How did she do it?
Alaska is an interesting place. So I've done some actual writing and stuff on Sarah Palin, sort of comparing her and talking about her with Hillary Clinton in 2008. And looking at her background a little bit more specifically. She has had a number of political positions in the state of Alaska, but all for very brief periods, which isn't the traditional trajectory for most any statewide candidates, let alone women. So being mayor, she was mayor of a pretty small city, but again, in Alaska, you can get some attention around that. She gained probably the most attention serving in a capacity, I believe, on an ethics environment board. She did resign from that, but had sort of raised enough issues statewide that she got a statewide persona and was supported then in obviously running for governor. I think how she then got from there to vice presidential candidate has been covered much in the media. But again, looking for, particularly on the Republican side in that year, but I think this has happened at the statewide as well as the national level, there have been cases in which, particularly on the Republican side, there have been efforts to sort of match that energy I mentioned earlier among women voters, to say, if we nominate a woman, if we select a woman, will she bring some of that support to us? And so I think that the McCain campaign looked to Sarah Palin as somebody who was fairly popular in the state, a Republican woman, a younger woman, contrary to him being an older candidate, and thought that she would bring something new to the ticket. But her path is unusual, and she continues to surprise. She was also one of the few governors to just step down in the middle of her term. She stepped down as mayor. She also stepped down off of the ethics board. So that's been, she sort of jumped from office to office.
She's, you know, she's essentially her career since then has been in the media through writing books, doing TV appearances, TV reality shows. Do you see her now as someone who could step back in to elected office?
I don't think she wants to. And I say that because I think if she was going to run again, she would have done it in the last cycle when there was speculation about her putting her name forward before and during the time that Michelle Bachmann decided to run on the Republican side for president. She had written a book. She had gone on a bus tour. She had been in New Hampshire and Iowa. And she had really been setting herself. She started her own PAC. She had set herself up for a possible presidential run and didn't do it. So I think at this point, both in the public's perception and I think in her own perception, she's less well situated and really sort of out of the sphere of floated candidates anymore. That said, I think she can still have an influence. She has demonstrated her capacity to be a mobilizer of public opinion and an aggravator in some regard on the media to sort of call out from a very conservative perspective both folks in the media and folks in politics. So it seems to me that she's found that her public voice is actually stronger outside of politics than inside of it.
How did she do, if you can measure that sort of thing, during her 2 years as governor of Alaska?
You know, it's hard to tell because what came out, at least during the presidential campaign, was really a lot of the negative. I think the biggest story about her 2 years was that it wasn't really enough time to do too much. The gubernatorial office in Alaska isn't particularly strong in comparison to some states like in Illinois or in New Jersey. And then there was a lot of question while she was in office about sort of, you know, who was in charge? Did she have other folks around her that were playing a significant role? I tend to think that sometimes we ask that more of women than we do of men.
That's something I was wondering about is, was she judged essentially for being a woman to some degree?
I think while she was in office by the people of Alaska, it did not seem to be the case that she had specific struggles due to her gender. She never talked about it that way. The coverage of her, the sort of history written about her time in office did not seem to indicate that, except for the scandals and things that came out largely when then she went to run for higher office, so when she had a child in office. And then there was all this discussion about, well, did she, you know, put the state in danger? Was she actually paying attention to the state? Was she hiding it, and was that bad evidence that she wasn't being honest with the Alaskans? There was questions when she was running about, did her husband play a larger role in her time in office than we knew? Is he the shadow governor? I think a lot of that was speculation. I don't even think it was happening significantly in Alaska at the time. It was more often used in the presidential campaign. And again, as I mentioned, I mean, questions about a woman being able to have a child in office, questions about her husband taking over behind the scenes, those are pretty gendered speculations and things that we've seen, unfortunately, face a lot of women running across the country, including Hillary Clinton.
Well, there's still time for your questions and comments about women in the office of governor. And if you have a question for our guests here on Focus, Kelly Dittmar of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers and Tom Kasich, political reporter at the News Gazette, call 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Tom Kasich, when you look at the pipeline now for strong female candidates who could, you think, make it on the state political stage, maybe in the legislature, maybe even in, I don't know if there are officials in municipal or county governments that have become better known. Is there anybody that you think could do it, or anybody who would want to?
Well, want to in Illinois, I don't know. But there are definitely people who could do, women who could do it. I made a little list. It's certainly incomplete. But I see especially a lot of Democratic women who could step in either for governor or any other executive office. And that includes three of our congresswomen, three of in Illinois right now, Tammy Duckworth or Robin Kelly or Sherry Bustos. Any one of those three, they're young enough and have demonstrated their vote getters.
Sherry Bustos is a downstate Illinois congresswoman.
Right, from the Quad Cities area. And I can see there's several state senators, Democrats, who are potential candidates, and that would be Linda Holmes, Kimberly Lightford, or Toy Hutchinson. Then there's a few Republicans, but the numbers aren't quite the same, just because the you talk about a pipeline, there just aren't a lot of Republican legislators right now, male or female. So it's going to be more difficult for Republicans. But I did look at some national numbers about the number of women in state legislatures, and Illinois is number 7. So we're well above the national average, with about 31% of the legislature is made up of women versus the national average of around 24%.
I'm wondering if there are some cases if someone comes from outside. You know, my producer and I were talking about Erica Harold,
yes,
who is running for Congress right now in the 13th District, and certainly meeting some resistance, it seems, from the Republican establishment. And the question is just because she's new to coming back to town after being out of town for a while, she's a former Miss America, which carries both a credit and a stigma, I think, with people, and she's challenging a first-term incumbent, and there's questions of whether that's a good thing to do or not.
The party has really lined up behind Rodney Davis, the incumbent congressman, who, you know, you have to go back 2 years, but both of them were in the so-called beauty contest to succeed Tim Johnson after he quickly announced that he wasn't going to run for re-election.
After he was renominated.
Yeah. So both Harold and Davis were in that group trying to succeed Johnson as the nominee, and Davis was selected very narrowly over Erica Harold. And so she still wants this race, and she wants the voters to decide it now versus the county chairman who did it 2 years ago. But the party establishment is firmly behind Rodney Davis.
And have they made it more difficult for her to run because of that?
In some ways. I mean, she wasn't given access to a voter data bank that may or may not be worthwhile anyway.
And would she have gotten that anyway, being a challenger?
If in an uncontested primary, they said yes, she would have gotten it. But and part of the reason was part of the data bank was put together by Rodney Davis, so he didn't want to give her information that he helped gather 2 years ago. So, you know, I can count on a dozen hands the number of people who've suggested that Erica Harold should either be running for the U.S. Senate or running for lieutenant governor. But she, you know, she was offered both by the party and decided she really wants to be congressman or congresswoman from this district.
Okay. And that raises the question is, does her gender play a role in the reception she's getting, or is it mostly because she's, you know, she lived outside of the district for several years? I mean, she grew up in this area, but then, you know, she went off to college. She was in Chicago. And now all of a sudden she's back just in time to run for Congress, it may seem to some people.
I suppose, you know, that there's all sorts of reasons that, you know, I get these nasty emails from people who don't even want us to write stories about her. And some of it is race-based, some of it is gender-based, some of it is the stigma of being a Miss America, some of it is that she's a carpetbagger. I don't know which one carries the most weight, but there's all sorts of negatives about her. But I will say she's a very good speaker, she's a very good candidate, and she should be a candidate at some point for some office. I mean, she should be a nominee.
Kelly Dittmar, I was just wondering if, as we close the program, you can look at what's ahead for women in the governor's mansion. Do you expect their numbers to change, to improve in the years to come, or is it going to continue to be a challenge for them?
You know, I think we're optimistic. You know, looking ahead to 2014, so 2014 is one of these large gubernatorial race years. Obviously, with your state being one of 36 that will have gubernatorial races, seven of those with open seats. And as I mentioned to you, I named a few of the women that are running. But we've had more women filing at about the, you know, as of this time when we look back at previous election years with similar numbers of races, we've had more women this time around at least being putting their names forward. So we think that, you know, women might be able to take advantage of the opportunities presented in 2014 to increase their numbers of women in office. That said, we currently have five women governors. We had nine previous high in 2004 and 2007. So even the progress we might be able to make this year might just bring us closer to where we were. So I think the secondary and more significant problem always for women in politics, and one that we need to address at all levels, but especially to get more women running and winning as governor, is to get more women in that pipeline, to get that list that you were just talking about, you know, to grow that list so that there are a number of women we can think about that the parties will support and that voters will rally around to run for office at the state legislative level, at statewide executive level for lieutenant governor and governor and any other federal offices. The more women we have in that pipeline, the more opportunities we have to fill any opportunities that come up, any seats that come up, and the more likely the women themselves will feel motivated to run as they see more women like them in office. So I think we're hopeful going forward. We see more women running. We see more electoral opportunities for them, but we still need to address the support structures, and we still need to continue to encourage women so that we get more candidates out there.
And Tom Kasich, in our final few seconds, ahead in Illinois, Lisa Madigan in 2018, maybe other people rising to the fore?
Oh, sure. Lisa, like I said before, she's still very young, and she's got two children. I don't know if that's a factor. She hasn't mentioned it if it is, but eventually her father is not going to be the Speaker of the House, and that'll clear the way for her to run for governor.
Well, I want to thank both of our guests, Professor Kelly Dittmar with Rutgers University's Center for American Women in Politics. And thank you, Tom, from the News Gazette, Tom Kasich, for coming on the show today as well for this program about women and the governor's office. And that will wrap it up today on Focus. Our producer is Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Jim Meadows for Focus on WILL.